Hi, and welcome back to A Palace for the People. We hope you've enjoyed the season so far. We have been on a short break getting some things done.
We hosted the NBO Lit Fest, which was a four-day writers' festival over three different locations in late August.
Which was absolutely amazing. I'm so proud we pulled that off.
And then I traveled to the Czech Republic, where a group of us visited public libraries, and I gave a keynote at the Libraries of Today conference in Olomouc.
And I spent some time in Cape Town doing book things.
And I just recently returned from the Global Philanthropy Forum in San Francisco.
Mm-hmm. Busy, busy times.
In the meantime, we are back with another episode of the podcast. And you know the drill. If you haven't yet, please go back and take a listen because this season has been...
Amazing? Can we say that?
We're allowed to say that.
I suppose we have to believe in ourselves first. It has been amazing.
Indeed. And so far in this season, we have made episodes about how history, real history, based off of items we have found while refurbishing the Macmillan Memorial Library in Nairobi, affects us as Kenyans, affects our government, our land, our environment, our schools, and our lives.
Okay, let's get started. This is A Palace for the People, a podcast about what Kenya's past tells us about Kenya's present. I am Wanjiru Koinange.
And I am Angela Washuka. On each episode of this show, we use an item that we found in the library archive as a jumping off point to explore a piece of our history and talk to some people who know the most about that history. Today's item is not an item.
Hey, what?
It's lots of items. The Macmillan's newspaper archive is massive. I remember walking into this room on our first visit, a room on the top floor, and it was just full of newspapers, floor to ceiling, some loose, some bound in volumes.
You could pick up a big bound book and it would have a title that said The Daily Nation from July to September 1963, or even farther back, like we have a copy of the East African Standard from 1903. I mean, I've done a lot of archival research in my past. I just have never seen so many newspapers, so many Kenyan newspapers, all in one place, spanning such a long, long time.
What's really interesting about this part of the archive is that most of the items we talk about on this show are things that are really stuck in the past, remnants of the library's colonial history. But the newspaper archives aren't static. Sure, we have some old newspapers, but the collection grew after independence and into the 1970s, 80s, and 90s. Today, we are going to talk about those papers and about the history of journalism in Kenya.
I think a free press is important precisely because it's in the nature of governments to go beyond what it is that they are mandated to actually do. And it is a free press that has sort of the ability to watch over the three arms of government, you know, the legislature, the executive, and the judiciary. You know, without a free press, you are in a very unsettling and an uncomfortable sort of position.
This is Professor George Ogola.
I'm a professor of media industries at the University of Nottingham in the UK.
And listen, I thought it was best to have the professor start at the beginning.
I like it. I approve.
No, because the news, the media, the free press, whatever you want to call it, isn't something that just exists. It is, and this isn't just Kenya, this is all over the world, something that people usually have to fight for.
So I would sort of characterize the media landscape in Kenya as fairly sort of typical of any landscape. So you've got the print, you know, broadcast and online. So traditionally, Kenya has always had a very strong print media. But of course, you know, in light of the technological sort of disruptions that have come forth over the last sort of decade or so, that sector of the media is actually shrinking quite a bit. In Kenya, as in a number of African countries, lots of media have relied significantly on advertising as their dominant, you know, source of revenue. And this advertising has always come from the private sector, but also from the state. The state being sort of the single largest, you know, advertiser in Kenya, as is the case in Tanzania, Uganda, or indeed Rwanda. Of course, that exposes it to, you know, a number of vulnerabilities, you know, so the state can leverage on the fact that it's the single largest advertiser to pretty much indirectly control the media. And that has happened, you know, in Kenya. It happened in the 1980s. It happened, you know, under successive sort of administrations, from the Moi administration to the Kibaki administration to the Uhuru administration, and indeed, you know, to the Ruto administration as well.
And it happened before that too. In fact, the earliest version of the modern Kenyan press came about during the struggle for independence.
That makes sense.
During the colonial period, information sharing was tightly controlled by the British settler government. Africans were banned from owning printing presses or newspapers. So many of the earliest Kenyan writers, organizers, and journalists had to find a way around. They partnered with progressive South Asian publishing houses to produce anti-colonial literature. Some early examples of this were publications like Muigwithania, Ramogi, Mumenyereri, Inororia Agikuyu, and Sauti ya Muafrika.
These were the main, we can call them pamphleteers. They were writing pamphlets in the colonial times. Many of them had to write, they were writing in their own languages. They had to kind of use words that did not raise alarm with the British. So that's why Muigwithania, the Reconciler, Mumenyereri, the Guardian, you know, they all sound, you know, we're just here to take care of the culture, to talk to people.
This is Dr. Njoki Wamai, a feminist scholar and professor at USIU in Nairobi.
But then people like Kagia and this other guy, Gakarawawa Jau, they were not even trying to mask what they were doing. It's like, we need our land back, freedom. But of course, it put them in a lot of trouble.
Many of these writers, like Bildad Kagia, Achieng Oneko, and Gakara Wawanjao, were in prison for their writing, and so were their publishers. The British deemed their publications to be seditious, a law that allowed for arrests of those deemed against the British monarchy.
Which they were. It wasn't their monarchy. These guys didn't consider themselves British colonial subjects. They were fighting for their independence from the British crown.
Yeah, but that wasn't really an allowable defense back then. But where one person would be arrested or a publication shut down or a publisher intimidated, more would come up in its place. Nyanza Times, Weavi, Mudhamaki, Radio Posta, Uhuru wa Afrika, Mwalimu, Mweadhi, Mwaraniria, Gikuyu na Mubi, Luo Magazine. There's more, I'm sure. Kenya's dissent publications could not be stopped, and they played a vital role in the struggle for independence.
The first independent government came up with a very useful popular project of nation building. And the media almost became part of that nation building project. So the media also saw itself as helping Kenya rebuild itself, to build a post-colonial sort of Kenya. But of course, you know, as the country sort of matured, the media then felt, you know, it had to go, you know, it had to follow a different path, felt it had this responsibility to hold, you know, this government, you know, accountable.
Which is, of course, kind of the whole point of a free press.
Because the nation-building project became a completely sort of different project. You know, it came, you know, a project through which the first government, you know, was sort of using to entrench its political dominance, jailing opponents, political opponents, corruption, you know, and ensued. And things that, you know, the media also felt were working counter to the vision that, you know, they had at independence.
So from that time, anybody who was seen to oppose the state was seen as an enemy. Anybody who had a different ideology, left ideology or communist Marx ideology, was an enemy, because we are capitalists, we support America. You know, in the whole balance of power between the East and the West, anybody who went against that, and you can see arrests actually because of publications starting as early as 1965, actually. So the first Kenyatta regime I mean, that was a proper dictatorship. And you can see the arrest of this the scholar who wrote Kenya to Endapi. Where are we going with Kenya? Also the 1966 book by Odinga's father, Jaramogi, asking, not yet Uhuru. Kenya is not yet Uhuru. So I think resistance has been ongoing. It's just that what is interesting is how it changes, because it never stopped. Kenyatta and the guy after him, Moi.
I mean, Moi wasn't exactly known as a champion for the free press.
Oh, no, 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 no. Many people we spoke with said that the Moi years were the very darkest days for the press in independent Kenya.
It was very difficult. You know, it was very difficult because Moi became an authoritarian, you know, and it was all about sort of political consolidation. It was all about the fracturing of the opposition. It was all about making sure that there was no opposition whatsoever, you know, to his rule. You are an actor that he saw as a threat, and the media was an actor at the time. He set out to destroy you.
And so, once again, Kenyans turned to underground publications as a form of resistance. And once again, the state used the crimes of sedition, but this time against its own citizens. One of those people was Dr. Wamai's uncle.
My uncle, Wang'ondo Kariuki, and he was the first Kenyan to be charged by the second dictator in Kenya, that is Daniel Arap Moi. So he was the first person to be charged for sedition and to be jailed. And the sedition charges was because he was allegedly arrested with a seditious publication, which is Pambana, one of the revolutionary newspapers of the time.
Pambana was the underground paper of the December 12 movement. And just possessing a copy would get you in trouble. It was one of many alternative publications at the time. And Dr. Wamai, with her colleague Kimani Waweru, are documenting and archiving these publications at Nairobi's Ukombozi Library.
Libraries.
Mm-hmm. Got to love them. The Ukombozi Library is also in the Nairobi CBD, like the Macmillan. It was established in 2017, but the collections are, of course, a bit older than that.
The library is really a collection. It was initially started as a huge donation of personal libraries of two Kenyan leftists and revolutionaries. One was Maina wa Kenyatta. So he gave his personal collection of, I don't know how many books, but there must be thousands. And also Nazmi Durrani, who is Shiraz Durrani, and Shiraz Durrani, both Shiraz and his brother Nazmi. So they gave a huge collection of books. Most of these books were the banned books. There were lots of these banned magazines, banned newspapers. Yeah.
These publications, which were seen as seditious under Moi, were kept safe and out of sight throughout the dictatorship. Some of them, the only remaining copies.
Also alternative newspapers. There was one called Society. And then there was also, was it Nairobi Law Monthly? All those were meant to be alternative newspapers, alternative magazines. And every time my dad used to read some of this, you'd tell me to close the curtains. And, you know, it's like it was the dictatorship. So you don't known to be reading what was seen as subversive.
The weekly review springs to memory immediately. We had a few copies scattered around the house when I was growing up.
Joe magazine on my end, which was, of course, set up in the 70s by Terry Hurst and Hilary Ngweno.
Yes, and Viva magazine as well.
It was a fashion magazine. And you would have also thought, you know, it's just fashion, women looking beautiful and stuff like that, and men posing. But through that fashion magazine, Viva magazine, they would write also subversive stuff.
So again, you know, it also talks about sort of the capacity of Kenyans to be very, to find sort of new ways of engaging or critiquing sort of the state. So it's not just through sort of the mainstream sort of platforms or narrative forms that we are used to. You know, there are also sort of alternative ways in which, you know, the state has always been held to account. I'm thinking of, for example, you know, Wahome Utahi. You know, the satirical writer who I actually did my PhD on the works of Wahome Mutai.
Shiro, I know you remember Wahome Mutahi.
Yes, I do. Whispers.
Yes, I had an uncle who was such a huge fan that he was nicknamed Whispers, which is probably how I came across the Sunday Column myself.
You know, this gentleman was a very good satirist, you know. So he turned to sort of fiction to criticize the state. So his fiction column, you know, Whispers, you know, which was widely read in Kenya, became almost sort of an alternative newspaper within sort of the mainstream newspaper, you know. So everything was sort of tongue in cheek. So he could not be taken sort of seriously by the state, by those who read that particular story were very much aware of what it is that he was talking about. The column was published in The Nation, but at the time sort of in The Standard, became a very powerful space through which the excesses of the state were constantly sort of exposed. Very innovative in the way he used language, in the way he uses imagery, but it also sort of his development of a narrative form that ruptured, you know, the boundaries that had been erected by the state to determine what was allowable and what was not.
The beauty about Whis is the way he told and he related part of his experience.
This is Msani Kimani Wawanjiro, a journalist, cultural critic, and satire enthusiast.
Many people saw themselves in it because, like, for instance, his experience growing up, if it's going to school that were managed by the church at that particular time. So anyone who grew up in the rural setting could relate and then transport Whispers into the urban setup. And now he's telling the stories of Eastlands, the stories of, you know, all those places. And again, you found ourselves resonating with those experiences. When artists realized that you could actually use satire and make people look at themselves, we can tell our truth in a way that we laugh at ourselves, but in a way also that questions some of the things that were happening. Whispers columns became very popular because of the way people laughed, but also people saw themselves in those situations. But then, the late Wahome Mutahi was one of those people who was arrested and detained in the notorious torture chambers under now Nyayo House. And he captures it in his book, 3 Days on the Cross.
3 Days on the Cross, Mutahi's prison book, is one of many prison writings by Kenyan authors.
Well, if you're throwing authors in jail, you're going to get a lot of prison books.
Mm-hmm. It's a genre Kimani became fascinated with.
So as a writer, I also now went into history of the struggle for liberation. And along the way, I came across the information that the first post-independent Kenya political prisoner was also a poet.
Wait, did he say poet?
Yes, he did. He is speaking about Abdi Latif Abdallah, who writes Kiswahili poetry.
That raised my awareness. It kind of raised my interest.
Kimani wrote a piece in The Elephant called Writings from the Inside about authors who published works about their time in prison. He lists Wahome Mutahi and Abdi Latif Abdallah, and honestly, a shocking amount more.
Ngugi wa Thiong'o, of course.
Of course. When Nyiri Kihoro wrote Never Say Die, Mainawa Kinyati, who we mentioned earlier, wrote Kenya, a Prison Notebook. There was also Comrade Inmate by Charles Gidai. And in fact, Mutahi would go on to write a second prison book called Jail Bags.
For me, it is part of looking at literature, but also connecting it with the people, the struggles of a country.
You know, this being an episode about dissent writers, I thought I would feel more like fired up, but I feel very sad, actually.
A lot of people made a lot of sacrifices, but I'll let Dr. Wamai close us out.
So we've had a history, but what is, I think, very inspiring is that despite all these breaks, that despite so much resistance from the state, there'll still be people who will come up and resist again through publications.
We dedicate this episode to the writers and journalists jailed for doing the work.
G.L. Vidyarthi,
Abdi Latif Abdallah,
Mainawa Kenyatta,
Mohamed Sheikh,
Wangondu Kariuki, Johan Wandeto,
Mumbi Wakinyati,
Guye Wathiongo,
Waniri Kihoro,
Willy Mutsunga,
Alamin Mazrui,
Otieno Mark Onyango,
Vincent Otieno,
Juguna Mutonya,
Wahome Mutahi,
and many, many, many more. This has been A Palace for the People. I am Wanjiru Koinange.
And I am Angela Washuka. This episode was produced by me, Angela Washuka, Wanjiru Koinange, Maeve Francis, and Ida Holinambi. As always, many thanks to our guests and experts for sharing their knowledge.